This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is January 27th, 1995. I'm in the Oral History Project office in the Red Gym, and Art Hovey and I are going to be interviewing Warrington Colescott today about his career in the art department at the university. Warrington, I'll ask the question that you generally start out the interviews asking. Could you talk about a little bit about your childhood and your background and your early education and your eventual entrance into the art field, art world?
Fine. I think that's a logical place to start. And in a way, I'm very closely connected to the First World War. And I think you find glimpses of warfare and military idiom throughout my work. My father was a citizen soldier in World War I, and he was a very successful one, a very good one. He became a first sergeant in the infantry, so that he was more or less in command on the non-commissioned officer level of a company. And his outfit went to France early in the war, and they fought through most of the war in France, and it was trench warfare. It was really, it was the most terrible war that this country had taken part in, although some Civil War buffs would argue that point. But his particular war was terrible, and it really left a mark on him, which in a way was transferred to me. My mother and father married after my father came back from the war. They were both New Orleans families, and they had decided to move to California, where I was born. I was born in 1921. In Oakland, California, where they settled. He was a brakeman for the Southern Pacific Railroad, part of the train crew. And he was a heavy father. He was a man of a temper, and kind of a troubled man, and a very tough father. So I always had my problems with him. As a child, I played with the things that he brought back from the war. One of my childhood play objects was his gas mask, for example. I would put on his gas mask at Halloween and go out and scare people. And his tin hat, which had a big dent in it. And so forth. The soldiers brought all of their gear home with them, and that was down in the cellar. And these were playthings, and we played war. The war was very much on the mind, I think, of the total population. It took a long time for this country to come out of the effect of World War I, and I think children in that period were marked by it. The reading that I did growing up had to do with war. When I went into the Boy Scouts at 12 years old, we marched in military formations, and we did close order drill. And it seems to me that I've been doing close order drill most of my life, because in high school, I went into the ROTC. Our high school had, you had a choice between gym and ROTC. And I think it shows my mindset that I opted for ROTC. And I became a colonel in the ROTC. That was the highest officer rank that we had in high school ROTC. So I was the colonel of our little regiment. And I can still do the Sabre Manual of Arms, because as a colonel, I carried a saber. and I can do that archaic bit. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the military stuff. At the same time, in high school, I drew cartoons. I think I've always been drawing pictures, you know, from the earliest period that I can remember. And in high school, I was the editor of the yearbook, and we had a kind of a weekly newspaper. I drew cartoons for that. So those were my interests. And then when I went in 1938, I went to Berkeley as an undergraduate. And again, waiting for me was ROTC. And you had no choice there. You had to take 2 years of ROTC. And you could be selected to take four and get your commission. But I took two. And I made a bad mistake in that a friend of mine who was in the engineering college, he joined the, we could sort of pick what branch we wanted to go. And he went into the Coast Artillery. And so I went into the Coast Artillery, which we got to fool around on big guns and track co-eds. It was fun. It was kind of an interesting, fun thing. But I don't think I was really suited to it. And because it really requires a great deal of mathematics and science, and I think the people in artillery have a certain kind of head that I don't have. And later, when the real war occurred, I was drafted, and I reported with letters of recommendation from my art professors, saying they thought I should go into camouflage or something like that. I was very talented, and they should use me in the right way. But they saw Coast Artillery on my record, and so of course I went into the artillery. And I think, I never really could advance very well in the artillery, in the Coast Artillery, which later became the anti-aircraft artillery, because of the mathematics and the elementary computers, the equipment, which was terribly complicated. So that there, in the Army, there were things I was very good at, but I was not good at trigonometry and triangulation and so forth. So in college, to go back to that period, because I think it was very important, Berkeley was a wonderful institution. It was large and very fine. It was a very fine school, still is. My father wanted me to be a doctor, so I started in the pre-med. I lasted one semester due to problems with chemistry and German, primarily. I'd taken an art course as an elective, and it was fortunately a 5-credit elective. And I got an A in that, which saved my bacon, or my college career would have stopped right there. And so I switched, and no one gave me any argument. I switched over to art and took my bachelor's degree in art.
Did you live at home?
No, I lived on campus. I was less interested in the art major and the formal artwork than in the university publications. They had a daily newspaper, which was quite a big deal, and the humor magazine, which was one of the best in the country. And I worked for both. On the Pelican, the California Pelican, we considered ourselves the best, although there was some argument about the Harvard Lampoon, but it was certainly one of the, at a time when campus humor magazines were very active, and They had people that graduated out of campus humor magazines and went into the publication field, into magazines, journalism, and on a regular basis. And of the people that I was associated with on the Pelican, there were at least five of them that went on to quite good careers in journalism. And one of them, Roberta MacDonald, was a staff cartoonist for the New Yorker for a long time. And so it was excellent training. And it was really, I think it was more important to me than the art major, where I was somewhat confused, frankly. The professors were good. They were an odd bunch. And I appreciate them more now than I did then. I worked with a Japanese professor, Akira Obata. He was practically non-verbal, but he taught things like oriental brushwork, and he would do these wonderful demonstrations with his brushes, and with paint he could put four brushes into each hand between the fingers. He would have a brush, and then he would ink up all of the brushes, and then he would hold them up like this, and he would say, "Now you tell me what you want to draw. You want me to draw a rabbit? Lobbit? I draw lobbit." And he would draw a rabbit, you know, in eight colors. It was, you know, wonderful skill this guy had, who had started training when he was about eight. And then on the other hand, we had Eugene Neuhaus, who was German and a great technician, who had written the book on the materials of the artist. And so for him, we ground colors, ground lapis lazuli, and we did true fresco out of doors, and tempera painting, all kinds of exotic things. So it was a very good department, and I think I learned a lot. Conceptually, I really didn't know where I was. I was kind of young. I was the sort of year behind most people. I was in all of my schooling. I was 1 year younger than most of the people in the school. So I was, when I started college, I think I was 17. the publication work was very attractive, and it appealed to my sense of humor and to the reading that I had done, and to the political thinking, which was really just beginning. You know, this was the time of Roosevelt, and essentially my politics were formed in that period, and they haven't changed very much. I think, in a way, I'm still a Rooseveltian Democrat. And the paper, I became art editor, so I had a small staff, and we did a daily piece on the editorial page, and we also did things for the sport pages. Our budget allowed us to do three drawings a week, and then for two of the assignments during the week, someone had to cut a linoleum block, because that was cheaper to print. And so I did a number of linoleum blocks, and I learned to cut linoleum quite well. And so those really are my first prints, although I just cut the block and then you give it to the printers and it appears in the paper. Because otherwise there was no printmaking at California at all. It was a very classical department. I think if I'd gone to an art school in any of the cities, I would have studied printmaking. But in the university, the art departments were somewhat experimental, and California was quite limited. The art department covered drawing and painting. You could do sculpture if you went over to the architecture school. And then there was a department of decorative art where you could do pottery and weaving and things. But all of these departments were very separate. So I drew and I painted. The art history courses were also in the art department, and that was one of my main interests. I really enjoyed the art history equally to the studio classes, and we did have some fine art historians on the staff, plus there were always visiting art historians that, to work with. On the Pelican, I wrote as well as drew, and I eventually became editor of the Pelican in my last year in 1942. So, you know, you had then the experience of actually doing the dummies and putting the magazine together. So it was a very valuable experience, and we were paid. We were all on salary. The war started in December of 1941, and it had a large effect on California because we were pretty close there. The Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor, and so in California there were blackouts on a regular basis, and there were kind of ghost raids. No one actually came, but the anti-aircraft went off, and you know, you thought something was happening, you know, eventually. But in the end, it turned out that it had been nothing. It was just a scare. But so the war was very close, and the class of 42, my class, we knew where we were going. It was right there. And so it was a funny time to be in school. And I did my part. I did parodies and satires for the war effort. And when you come out to the studio, I'll show you some of the things. How, for example, I had a spread on how to handle an incendiary bomb. Similar things. Well, I graduated in the summer of 1942. I was a little behind, probably because of the publications work, so it took me an extra summer session. I had a very good draft number, which my 21st birthday was in March, and it was into the fall before I actually was called up, and there I went down to Monterey with letters of recommendations from my good professors, which were ignored, and I went into the artillery. I did basic training in the Coast Artillery, and then I went to Officer Candidate School in North Carolina, which was the anti-aircraft candidate school, and eventually realizing that it was unfortunate that I had gone into the artillery, because it was very difficult for me. The amount of math and the quantity that you had thrown at you was very hard. So I really had to study hard, much harder than most of the other people who had engineering backgrounds or something like that. But still, I did manage, and then I was assigned, when I was assigned to my unit, which was the 483rd Anti-Aircraft Battalion. I had to look that up, which was an independent battalion of anti-aircraft guns, 40-millimeter Bofors semi-automatic guns, and some odd 50 caliber machine guns on multiple mounts. So again, all very complicated stuff. And I guess I go into this because I found that my job was to teach We started with raw recruits, you see. We formed in Fort Bliss, El Paso, and the officers were responsible for teaching their men what to do, how to do it, and that included everything, even in some cases, how to write their name. And so for most of the period, it took a long time to train this group, and so I was a teacher. And I found that although the material was difficult for me, and often I was only a few hours ahead of the men I was teaching, that I was a very good teacher. I found that I did have teaching skills, and I think I really learned how to teach in the Army, because that's basically what I did. By the time our battalion was trained, the war had changed and we no longer needed the quantity of anti-aircraft, and so our whole outfit was retreaded into infantry, and I had to go to school again. I went to Fort Benning to the infantry school. And I found I was much better at the infantry, at the things that the infantry had to know. The weapons were simpler. And I really enjoyed tactics. Tactics really consist of sneaking up on someone and doing them bodily harm. And you know, I could manage that.
I had a lifetime career.
Yeah, right. I had, to a certain extent, a sneaky nature. And so I became very good at tactics. I think if I'd gotten into that earlier, I might have gotten to be a higher rank. From Benning, I went to Camp Howes in Texas again, where essentially we were a cadre, and we were training people that were being retreaded. Troops were, they were shaking down all of the people who had been clerks and who were what the Republicans are trying to do now. They would feed them then through Camp Howes. In 8 weeks, we would send them over through the Battle of the Bulge. And some of them would actually come back to the hospital on base, all shot up, which meant that, you know, we'd been successful. And it was so horrific that I volunteered. I had to get out of it, and I volunteered for the parachute corps. God help me if I really had been successful. But they saw that I was serious and that I wanted to get out, and so they shipped me out to the Pacific. And I got to Okinawa for just the last phases of the war there. What I participated in were skirmishes. And because of my artillery background, I had mortars. I had 80-millimeter mortars. And again, that's a perfect instrument for a sneaky person. You sneak up behind a hill where no one can see you, and you send a corporal way up to the top of the hill, and then he spots where your shells are landing. And but that didn't last very long, because I was on Okinawa when the atomic bomb went, when the two atomic bombs were done in Japan, and that quickly finished the war. And the discussions of that time are interesting to me, and my son's feelings about the inhumanity of dropping these bombs on Japan are interesting to me, because it's my feeling that if they hadn't been dropped, my sons would not exist, because I was in the 7th Division, and we were to be the lead troops in the landing in the Bay of Tokyo. And we knew where we were going, and we were in training for that. The war was over, thank God, but my part wasn't finished, because 7th Division was moved into Korea as occupation troops, and so I spent about another eight months in Korea, again doing everything. I learned so many skills. I was the transport officer in our move, so I learned how to fill a ship with troops and equipment. First on, last off. And I did lose a tank in this loading operation. It wasn't really my fault, but.
How do you lose a tank?
You drop it into the ocean. And I was responsible for a lot of damage here and there in my Korean trip, because I did all kinds of things. I was trial judge advocate. I had to actually prosecute soldiers who had killed people, raped people. I remember we had a man who killed a woman over an egg, the price of an egg, and he shot her. These troops, that division had been in the Pacific for a long time. That's why, you know, as a replacement officer, I was welcome, because it meant that someone went home. So it was really very easy to join this group, but they were partially insane. They really, neurotic at best, insane on the average. We had a lot of crime and problems in Korea, with a captive populace. We were guarding equipment, Japanese equipment that had been left over, and it was a very cold winter, and Japanese equipment consisted of fur coats and winter equipment and so forth, and the poor Koreans would try to get in at night and steal things, and our troops would shoot them if they had to. You know, it wasn't that heartless. Very often, they let them go too. And to a certain extent, it was kind of dangerous. There were dangers involved. The greatest danger was bad liquor. And one of the things I learned how to do, I had to study a manual before taking a squad out and doing formal funerals, burial groups, where you have a firing squad where you're fired into the air as the coffin is lowered down. And other things I had to do, but I did a lot. And anyway, finally, I got back and I got out of the Army in 1945. In the spring of 1946, I see my notes, when I was shipped home and discharged. So I started to write my novel at that point. And I decided if I got a publisher interested, this was in the spring of 46, and if I found some interest in this, that I'd maybe go back to grad school and go into the writing course. And if I didn't, I'd go into art. I'd go back and take a graduate degree in art. Well, I didn't find any interest. Maybe a half dozen chapters written, and I made the mistake of showing it to a journalist friend who had been the editor of the Daily Cal when I worked there, and she tore it apart. She was unmerciful on it, and probably very accurate and probably meaning to be constructive, but it crushed me. I turned against my own work. I went into the graduate program in art. And this time with no publications to distract me, I did very well. I did very well. And I began to come alive as an artist at that point. I guess I was older. I had things to think about, things to make art out of. I had had, a great many experiences. And I began to work with a couple of people who were just right for me at that time. And one was a woman, Margaret Peterson O'Hagan. a Canadian woman who was a very fine abstract painter. And so my work, which had been figurative, became more abstract. She was very helpful in the color work too. She really had a fine sense of color, and she had the design knowledge to be able to transfer her sensibility to a student. And I got my master's, again, a year and a summer, which is my use seems to be, I was always one summer session behind the world. But I did also, I got a teaching certificate, a junior college teaching certificate, which requires a minimum of education classes. But I did take the basic education classes. So that's through my, yeah, only through my first page. Okay, fine. I got very good letters from people I'd worked with, and so I got a good job in at a junior college in Southern California, Long Beach Community College, 2-year college, where we really had a two-pronged program. They either had a terminal education of 2 years, which put them into some kind of a job market, or they went 2 years with us and then transferred as juniors into UCLA. That was most of the thing. And I enjoyed the teaching, the department. There were four people in the department, and I was teaching drawing and painting. And at that time, I was exhibiting quite a bit. I like to exhibit, I always have. And so I was exhibiting painting. My colleague there, a person that I liked very much, Fred Heidel, who he and his wife were there, Florence Heidel. And she did woodcuts, and Fred did silkscreen prints. They had studied at the Art Institute of Chicago, where they had a background in printmaking. And they had known Dean Meeker there, as a matter of fact. Later when I came here, I found that Meeker had been very friendly with Fred Heidel particularly. So Fred was a good colleague, and he showed me, he got me interested in prints, and helped me build the screens, and taught me how to make the silk screens work. I didn't know I would do anything with it, but when I began to play around with it, I got interested, and so it developed. And that was in 48, and after about a year, I was showing screens in various exhibitions. We had Fred and I and Florence, and there were three other people. We had the opportunity to show as a group at the San Francisco Museum of Art in 49. Six artists from Southern California. And we had a very nice show there, got good reviews and so forth. And all of this was encouraging, encouraging to in the production, the serious production of art, and also once you produce it, get it out and use it. Things seemed to be going well. And unfortunately, Fred and I got into a conflict with the other two members of the department. There were only four people in the department, and pretty soon it was split right down the middle. There was a sort of design-oriented pair, a potter and the designer, against the sort of painting, printmaking-oriented pair. And it's hard to think back over what we were fighting about, but at the time it was serious. And since the potter was the chair of the department and really had the power, Fred quit first. He had an offer to go to the University of Oregon, and I quit too. my plan was to go to Europe. That I did have, my wife and I had a good friend in Florence, Marcella. And Marcella had found us an apartment that sounded nice. And so I thought, well, we'll go on the GI Bill and go to Florence, and to hell with teaching. Which we would have done, except at the last minute I had the offer from Wisconsin. I had a phone call from Fred Logan, and he kind of interviewed me, and I was tempted. We were awfully broke to go to Europe. I mean, my wife was willing to go, but it would have been a financial risk just to go. We had no savings, no nothing. And so it was a risky maneuver. And on the other hand, Wisconsin sounded good. You know, I knew its reputation. And my long-range plan was to get into a large university, to get into an art department in a large university. And so I decided to take the, and so I accepted without ever having been to Wisconsin. In those days, you know, money was tight. It's tight now, but they fly you in now.
How did Fred find out about you, or did you apply? Or how
did I had my papers into an agency in Chicago. This was, you know, if you were looking for a job, this is one of the things you did. The private agencies were much more used then than they are now. And so he had seen my papers there, and that got him interested. And so with a phone call, he hired me. Of course, you know, I was being hired as an instructor, which is a one-year contract. And when I got here, I found that there had been many instructors through, and then after a year they were let go, so it was a very temporary job. And so that's how I got here, and I never left. Although when I came, I certainly didn't think I would be here very, very long. I came with a cut in salary. Salaries in California had been rather good, and the salaries here were awful. You know, I think all of the people that came, the ones we've interviewed, came at very, very low salaries. They're so low I've forgotten them. I've wasted them out of my mind. It's unbelievable. And I don't think the salaries, the upper salaries, were that much better either. I mean, really, people were working for peanuts. But the situation, of course, was that the universities were under tremendous pressure. Students that wanted to get in, you had the enormous field of GIs with the GI Bill paying their way and encouraging them to go. And so the universities were just expanding rapidly overnight. I was hired along, I think there must have been three other people hired at the same time, all on the same level, instructors. And the people that were here hadn't, most of them hadn't been here very long either. There was this little core of people left over from the small department that it had been before the war, Helen Annan and Potter, Dora. Anyway, she was about the same age as Annan. George Dietrich had been off to war, and he was back. He was returning. He wore his naval uniform while he taught his classes, which we thought was pretty odd. But then he was a very cold, distant character that I never did get to know him well. Fred Logan had been chair and had hired me, but when I got here, Helen Annan was chair at the beginning of the academic year. That's 49-50. And so the department had changed. The power structure had shifted, and I found that it had been doing this sort of back and forth for a number of years, and that there was an intense struggle going on between the old guard and the new people. And Logan was the leader of the new group. He was an intelligent, hardworking man, an art educator, and from Milwaukee, and he had close ties to Sessler and to Zingali. Arthur Wirthaler, who taught metal, had ties as well. These people had all had some experience together in the art world in Milwaukee and during the Depression to a certain extent, and had backgrounds in at the college in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee State College there. My first meeting with Sessler was interesting. Fred took me around a little and took me into the painting room and left me in the hands of Santos Zingali. And then so Santos took me down to a Quonset hut that was on the library mall. The library mall had about a half dozen Quonsets at that time. They were left over from the military, some of the military classes. And the art department faculty had a Quonset that was their studio, and they had the little cubicles within the Quonset. And we came quietly into the Quonset, and then I realized that someone was sleeping on a stool in front of an easel. The easel had a tiny little picture on it. And he was sleeping in a very precarious position. He was leaning against his mall stick. A mall stick has a little round ball on one end, and you put it on the easel, and it has a cushion on the other end. It's kind of flexible stick. I'd never seen a mall stick before, except in museums. Anyway, so he was leaning against his mall stick, which was on the easel, and he was sound asleep, snoring a little. So we woke Al up, and that was my first introduction to Sessler. And so I liked Sessler and Zingali a lot. I liked Fred, too. They were warm, friendly people, and they were really welcomed me into the department. The first few years, I taught design and drawing, strictly basic courses, but the department was in the old journalism building, which fronted on the lake. Wonderful view. There was a beautiful room, the design room in particular, had a whole bank of windows facing the lake, and the only interruption was you can see a little of the ski jump, which was on the hill there. And I kept feeling that I was in this exotic place. You know, I really was. Madison was terribly exotic. And at one point, I had a student. Students would leave class during the breaks, and in the winter, they would go out and take a run down the ski jump, and then come back to class. And so during the break, one of my students went out, took a run down the ski jump, broke his leg, and came back to class a week later on crutches. And you know, I noted that down in my mental notebook. So it was, you know, the pay was poor, but the company was good. I found that I had a lot in common with Dean Meeker, that we were both doing serigraphs. He, at this time, he had a class in serigraphy, which he had just started. And the other thing that we had in common, that the whole group had in common, was the interest in exhibiting. And prints were particularly, they fit in this because they were easy to send off. And prints were on an upswing all over the country. There were a lot of shows, small shows and some big shows too. The museums were interested. The museums were getting into this and forming important shows. So Sessler was sending off his work, and Dean and I, Zingali would send off to painting shows, and after a little bit we had a kind of lunch group. We met in one of the offices and ate bag lunches, brown bag lunches, and just happened to have an entry blank that had come back, you know, with a note that you'd won a prize, or you got in the show, or something good, you know, and you just happen to take that out during lunch and kind of wave it around. And maybe someone else, you know, had gotten a note back saying they were rejected. So they had to admit, yes, they had sent, but they hadn't made it, and someone else might have sold something. And so on. So there's friendly competition developed, which was enjoyable. I mean, I am a competitor, and I do like to compete, and I like to win, but it doesn't, I don't take it too seriously if I lose either. And so the feeling was pretty general there. And later, when Harvey Littleton joined the staff, he was a part of the group too, because he was exhibiting in pottery shows in the same way. And so we, an amazing number of times, we did win. I mean, this little group in far from where the shows were being, we developed quite a good record in these shows. Well, what happened next? A few words, I think, about the political situation in the department. The dean of the School of Education, which we were in, our dean, was Dean John Guy Fowkes, who was an imposing person. He was not to be taken lightly. And I think his policy was to keep the art department terrorized. And we were all young and foolish enough to be terrorized. But, you know, in retrospect, I think, and meeting him later after he had left the deanship, he was a very smart man. He was something of a manipulator of people. But he was trying to build the department, and actually he was supporting the newer people that were being hired into the department. And he was also protecting the people, some of the people in the department, primarily the Milwaukee group, from forces on the campus which were really out to get them, because it was the time, we sort of moving now into the time of McCarthy. And so the anti-communist, anti-liberal, you know, anti-left forces in the university were very organized. And it was known that Zingali had been in the Communist Party, so he was a target. And because of the closeness, I think, of Sessler and Logan, and their activities in the WPA, and there, Sessler had not joined anything, but he had sort of been along on it. So they were targeted, and also they were targeted by the conservative elder group in the department. So the Annan. What was her name? The other woman?
Wilson.
Della Wilson. Ann and Della kind of led the charge and put the finger on. And so things that I was unaware of were happening, and that From Zingali's tape, I think you see some of the incidents. And but John Guy defended them and defended them very ably. And so they were nervous, but nothing untoward happened. I think it probably cost them some things and raises and so forth. And eventually, Annan and Della retired. And my feeling, I don't know Della Wilson very well. Again, like Dietrich, she's somewhat of a shadowy figure, but I knew Helen pretty well, and I was somewhat sympathetic to her. She was a strong woman. The most negative take on Helen was that she was anti-Semitic, and I do think you have to consider the time and the period and so forth. And a great deal of her personality had to do with her husband, who was a kind of low-level fellow electrical contractor. And if you went to a dinner party with Petey, you really had to still yourself for crude talk. He was kind of his social graces were few and far between. So that was something. Helen had to deal with this all the time, and so she was with her friends and protecting her friends. And as an artist, she wasn't that bad. It's just that her work was polite and quiet. She did rather nice, quiet watercolors, decorous watercolors. And I think as a teacher, she wasn't bad either. She was a little behind the sort of contemporary movements. She wasn't contemporary, and she was rather anti-modern. But she wasn't a bad administrator. And so when she was in, things ran fairly smoothly, and in some ways more smoothly than when Fred was in. It was a department, when I came here, it was the Department of Art Education. And then after a few years, it became the Department of Art and Education. And I think I might have had something to do with it, because I became a player to a certain extent. As a one-year instructor, the amount that you can put into play is limited. But on the other hand, you know, I was encouraged to play. The people, the other, hardly anyone had tenure. You know, we were really talking, there were the instructors and then there were the assistant professors. So really it was a very lightly ranked group, so even an instructor could play a part in it. And so I felt we really were an art department. The art education part was a much smaller part, and so at least get the art into it. And then gradually the art education was moved out of the title. We became the Department of Art, finally. And I think the whole field of art education, it is interesting, it is a field that has been diminishing. Initially, it had its literature and its people, its operators and thinkers. It was really a very strong movement. And it has been diminishing and diminishing until now. It's hardly a field at all. I think in the department there now, essentially two people in that area, and I think it only exists here because we're in the School of Education. But in the earlier days, Fred was very much into this. He was active. He was writing his book, which was finally published, on education, art education methods, and a number of the visitors we had were the thinkers and the writers, and they had their own magazine. So It was an active field, but it was going nowhere. I became chair, strangely, I guess. I got more interested in the department. I had things that I was more interested in teaching came my way. I began to teach painting, and that for me was a big deal. I think one of the nice things about the people in the department, they did share. We had a lot of enrollment. We had a lot of graduate students. That was expanding. And so we needed new sections. And there wasn't this thing of trying to corner the classes that you're interested in and keeping people out. So I really was invited in, and so I soon had classes in painting to teach, and so I had really decided then that I was staying here for a while, and I was promoted, and I've lost my notes. In 58, I was up to full professor. The promotions came faster than they do nowadays. I think I was an instructor for 3 years and an assistant professor for 3 years, or maybe even less.
Assistant professor two, and I think only associate only one.
Yeah.
And then full professor.
Full professor in 1958.
Yeah.
So after a relatively short time. And I didn't realize it, but they were grooming me to be chair. Fred, I guess, and I'm not sure, Singali would probably talk to this better, why Fred had been chair. He had been chair initially, Annan came back, and then Fred resumed as chair. Now, why he didn't keep it longer, why he groomed me to be chair, I'm not sure. I got along tolerably well with Helen. I guess I was the peace candidate, but I didn't seek the chairmanship. As a matter of fact, I only took it for 2 years. I took it because I was elected to it. And we had a house rule that if you are elected, you do it. You really can't say no. Although people, later on, people did say no. But I didn't have any feel for administration. I felt that I was a classroom teacher. I was happy teaching painting, drawing, design, all of those things. My interest in prints was not heavy enough to really want a print class at that point. Painting was really still my main thrust, and I was exhibiting and painting steadily and doing well. I had a painting show in New York. I was in two Whitneys, and so forth. So my paintings were still more major to me than the prints, although I was doing a lot of serigraphs. We had moved into the education building out of journalism. Which was an expansion for us. We had more space. Some new, very well-equipped studios in education, the basement level with Art Metal had particularly fine facility there, and pottery. It looked good then. And the print studio was an improvement. Painting and sculpture did very well. I think by this time we had Leo Steppett, or possibly when I was chair, I think I might have had something to do with the hiring of Leo. As a matter of fact, I know I did, because I remember going to New York to see his, he had a show at the Forum Gallery in New York, and I went there to see that exhibit, because I'd heard about him. And if I had any ideas about being chair, it was to try to strengthen the art side of the staff. And I'm not sure if I hired Harvey, but while I was chair or not, but I had a lot to do with the hiring of Harvey. It could have been earlier.
It was earlier.
It was earlier. But it seems to me I was on the committee that hired Harvey. I almost personally hired Marjorie Krylik with great opposition. It was a male chauvinist staff. I think because of the difficulty they had had with Della and Helen, but there definitely was an anti-woman bias. And I wanted Marjorie for that reason, and then also I was very impressed by her work at Toledo. And she was a real designer. We had, everybody else had been playing at design. You see, I've been playing at design. Essentially, I was teaching a painter's course in design. It was really kind of an elaborate course in composition. But Marjorie had a background in textiles, and she came out of the design market and the design industry, and she'd been in the Toledo Museum of Art School and teaching design, and had a fine reputation. So I was happy to get her. And again, I'm not sure Leo came while I was chair, but I remember that I was on the committee